अर्थाय प्रतिशोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृषितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् तद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्तधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
Okay, we're in verse 29.
Sarvabhutastamātmānam Sarvabhūtāni chātmani, Sarvabhūtāni chātmani, Īkṣate yoga yuttātmā, Īkṣate yoga yuttātmā, Sarvatra samadarshanah, Sarvatra samadarshanah. Sarvabhūtastam, Sarvabhūtastam, Ātmānam, Sarvabhūtāni cha ātmani, Ikshate yoga yukta atma sarvatra sama darshanaha. Ikshate, the one who sees, Ikshate. Yoga Yuktatma, the one whose mind is, Yukta means like endowed with yoga. What that means is the one whose mind has become proficient in contemplation. The one who's able, proficient, so I'll talk about that in a minute. Exactly what does that mean to become proficient? The one who is capable of contemplation. Just basically, the one who, having gained this knowledge, is able to see it. Able to see it in the sense of if I know I am Brahman at the time of teaching, I've recognized I am Brahman. I've seen that clearly at the time of teaching. The one who can resolve one's mind into that fact, what we'll see what it means by to resolve the mind into that fact also. If my mind is able to appreciate that, to see it, to recognize the truth of it, then I've become somebody who's proficient at contemplation. So by yoga they mean, yoga means to join. What they mean by join here is not joining two things, one with another. It's the mind's recognition of recognizing the self, recognizing myself as Brahman. It's recognizing myself as the Atma. So I'll unfold that a little bit more later. So for now, the one whose mind is capable, is able to do, to contemplate, to recognize oneself. What does that one see? That one sees sarvabhutastam atman. Sees means sees in the sense of knowing, not in the sense of seeing an object. Recognizes. So one recognizes oneself as being the self abiding in all beings. Sarvabhuta means all beings. Sarva all, bhuta all. Sarvabhutastam, the one who is remaining there. Abiding in, remaining there, abiding there. The Atma, Atmanam, the one who sees the self, abiding in all beings. So the Atma, the self that I am, I see that self as the self of all beings. So I have a self, you have a self. Myself is yourself. I recognize myself as being your very self. Not like yourself, but being your very self. So the one who sees that, sees that their self, that this self, the self that I am, is the self which you are, which is the self that all beings are. So, sarvabhutastam atman, the one who sees that, and sarvabhutani cha atmani, and also sees sarvabhutani, all beings, in the self. So I see myself, so looking at it both ways, I see my being, this atma that I am, as being yourself, your Atma. The Atma that I am is the Atma which is in all beings. And then also I see all of these beings being in the one self. Do you see what I mean? It's this self that I am is in all beings, and this all beings are in the self. So the yogi yuktatma is the one who sees that. And then he says one other thing. Sarvatra, in other words, that yogi yuktatma, who is the yogi yuktatma, the one who is this proficient in contemplation? Sarvatra samadarshanaha, the one for whose vision, darshanaha, the one who is seeing, sama, that which is the same everywhere. Sarvatra means everywhere, in everything. That tra affix is a locative incarnable affix. Sarvatra, so in everything, everywhere. The one who sees darshana, for whom, the one who is seeing, darshana means seeing, that which is sama. Sama is the word, how they're using sama for the atma. The one who is seeing that which this is the same everywhere. So, to me that is the nididhyasana that is natural to the jnani. The one who sees that which is the same everywhere. Another way of saying it, the one who sees the Atma everywhere. Because I'm the whole. So what does it mean to see, for one to see that which is the same everywhere? Well, what is the same? In the creation is a manifestation of infinite diversity, of infinite duality, of infinite multiplicity. In fact, there is nothing the same. There is nothing the same, and everything is infinitely divisible, and not only that, from moment to moment, everything is different. So there's no samatvam, there's no sameness here. There's sameness in the diversity. There's sameness in the duality. You can say like that. Everything is the same in that everything is absolutely different. Everything is dual. Everything is in a constant change. But to see that which is sama in everything is to see the satyam. The satyam and the mitya. It means to see the satyam and the mitya. It means to see myself in everything. The only thing that is the same in my experience. If you take your experience now, the experience of this moment is your own presence, the sat-chit. Your presence is the sat-chit. Sat means your being, the amness that you enjoy, and the consciousness. The sat which is chit, the chit which is sat. So when you say, I'm a conscious being, that conscious being never wavers at all. Our problem is to be able to see this conscious being that I am in everything as the self of everything, to see it everywhere, requires the viveka, the discrimination that allows me to differentiate the sat-chit from the upadis, everything I take myself to be. If I take myself to be the body, the sat-chit, the conscious being that I am, if I've superimposed myself on this physical body, right, then consciousness is limited by this physical body because I say, I am the physical body, right? And so if I say, I am the physical body, or I am the mind, I am my thoughts, there's an adhyasa, there's a superimposition going on there, which allows the body, mind, sense organs to claim the I am to itself. And then I become a subject different from you, the object. And that's normally how we live in the world. That's how we experience the world. I am the subject, you are the object. Because the mind, which always enjoys, mind which is always illumined, always enjoying sat-chit, you would never say that your mind is free of consciousness. You always experience your mind as having consciousness. And you always experience your mind as having the physical body for its locus. Even though the mind goes traveling all around and it dreams and all of these things, you still consider it as having this as its basis, as its base. This mind and these sense organs are located here in this physical body. So this becomes as though a unit. And so this sat-chit, the consciousness which I am, the conscious I, the being that I am, is taken to be this physical body, even though when we analyze it experientially, when we analyze our experience, your conscious, the consciousness that you are, is in fact something that can easily be differentiated from all of the things that you objectify, which includes your body and your mind and your sense organs. All of these things are changing. All of these things actually belong to the whole creation. And you can actually recognize that in your experience. And that has to be recognized. That has to be recognized in order to see that the Satchit which you are is the Satchit which everything enjoys. You see, if you take the consciousness to belong to this body, right, then this consciousness that actually is changed, the consciousness that is me, in fact, that makes me me. Remember the mind, the thoughts and moods and emotions of your mind, they're always coming and going. They don't take consciousness with it. When a thought goes, it doesn't take the consciousness with it. It just goes. It's gone. The thoughts come and they go. The emotions come and go. Even your identification and perception of the physical body comes and goes. You're not walking around all of the time aware of your physical body. What about when you're reading a book? What about when you're driving? What about when you're talking with a friend? You check in and you're, oh yes, here's my body. You don't have to say that, but if you just notice how often are you actually not cognizant of your physical body? Or not even cognizant of your sense organs. What about when you're daydreaming? You know, you're just cognizant of whatever is going on in the mind. And whatever is going on in the mind is only going on in the mind for that second. It's because something else is going to be going on the next second. And so your whole experience of the world includes not just your experience of the world objectified by your sense organs, it includes the experience of your body, your mind, your sense organs, your thoughts, your moods, your emotions. All of these things are in constant flux. But you don't think about it like that. You never think about it like that because you are not in constant flux. Your being is not in constant flux. The Satchit is a constant. You are the constant. But because you are the constant and everything else changes, you can differentiate yourself from those things which come and go. You cannot be something which comes and goes if you're still here. And so that differentiation is something that is actually aproksha. It's immediate, it's direct, it's there for you to recognize. But now, once it is recognized, there are serious repercussions to that recognition. You know? It is that the conscious being that you are does not belong to anything. It doesn't belong to anything. Because everything that you experience, including the body, the mind, the sense organs, is in constant flux, constant change, and it isn't. So it can't belong to it. Mm. Right? Because as it changes, you don't. If it doesn't belong to it, nor can it be objectified to become one of the objects in the creation, then the Satchit, which is you, which is your being, right, isn't contained by any given object in the universe, including your body, mind, sense organs. But let's just say it like this. The me that I have experienced as my body, mind, sense organs, that I've superimposed on it, what about once I recognize that it is free, that it's not contained, that this me is stable, that it's not contained? Then this body, mind, sense organs gains the same status as all other objects that are being perceived. Because really, the body, mind, sense organs are perceived by the mind and the same five sense organs that perceive the rest of the world, right? And so this body, mind, sense organs belongs to the world, belongs to Ishvara. It is part and parcel. It's like if you say there's a cell in the body belongs to the body, we'll say this body is a cell in Ishvara. This cell belongs as part and parcel of Ishvara. And the self, which is not contained, Right? Now we experience differently. Once you give your body, mind, sense organs over to Ishvara, then now, if you recognize this, that self which is conscious being, I am a conscious being, okay, but not contained in the body, then look at your experience. Now all of a sudden the experience is different. Now say the experience just of this room. This whole room enjoys the being which I am. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. The whole thing has being. I might as well say it am, because my experience of, I have no experience of isness. I attribute the word is to my amness, because I don't want to recognize that there is only amness. Right, so I call this the painting, it is, and then I say, I am. But there is no transformation of my experience of amness into an experience of isness. You see, I don't have amness in reference to me, the individual. I experience I am. And then all of a sudden, amness changes or modifies into isness. You either can say like this, I is, and so is everything else. Or I am, and so is everything else. There's only one experience of being. Being is its one singular experience without any subject-object division. There's subject-object division only to the names and forms. There's no subject-object division to the experience of being, nor can the experience of being be something that is looked at. So the experience of being is my amness. The experience of consciousness also. Now that becomes different. I notice that not only is all of this known, so for known I'll use consciousness. All of this is known means all of this exists within consciousness. This body equally exists in consciousness. The mind exists in consciousness. The sense organs exist in consciousness. The emotions exist in consciousness. The I thought exists in consciousness. There is nothing that's away from consciousness. I have no experience that's away from consciousness. I have experiences that are away from the body. This painting is 10 feet from the body. There's experiences like that within this duality. But there, I have no experience that's away from consciousness. So consciousness, which is existence, the sat-chit, is the sama. So the one who sees this which is the same everywhere, right? That is the one who is proficient in yoga. That's the one whose mind is proficient in contemplation. Because you see the self in all beings and all beings in the self. We think of it as contemplation. You can think of it as contemplation. Another way of thinking of it is just knowledge. It's like this, what is being told here is the reality that you see or you don't. And if you have knowledge, then even though your mind, if you have self-knowledge, means as the teaching is working as a pramana, so it's taking you to this recognition, then this is what you see, except when you don't. And when you don't because complexes or habitual ways of thinking are rising up. And then in fact, then at that point, you bring in contemplation. What does that mean? You bring in your knowledge. Knowledge is simply that cognition, that prama, that cognition, which matches reality. That's what we mean by this yoga yuktatma, the mind that is able to see. With a mind that is able to see, in the sense of self-knowledge, is the mind that has knowledge. So what does that mind see? It sees everywhere that samatvam, that which is the same. That which is the same is the sat-chit. That the objects are not able, because the dehatma buddhi has become mitya. The dehatma buddhi means that identification with the body, that has become mitya. Means you're able to see that the Satchit which you are is the Satchit of this body and this space and everything that exists within your perception. That's what you recognize it. It's not like you're superimposing something on that. You see that reality. So the one who sees that, right? Then what is that? Then now another thing. So the one who sees that, then what are they seeing? They're seeing the Atma in all beings. This self that I am, right, is the self that you are. So you are a conscious being, you're a conscious being, you're a conscious being, you're a conscious being, you're a conscious being. Right? And so who is the conscious being? It's the Atma. It's me. So I see the self. I can say I see myself, the self which is me, in all beings. And then I see all beings, the whole Krishna, all beings in the self. Why? Because there's nothing away from Satchit. There's nothing away from consciousness. There's nothing away from existence. These beings, all the names and forms that you experience in the creation, they have no being of their own. Because all of them are coming into being and going out of being. Everything. Everything that within duality, coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being. Everything. What isn't coming into being and going out of being is being. Everything else is, in a sense, borrowing that being. In the sense that when it is there, it has being. When it's not there, it doesn't have being. Being is the stable. The staple. Being is what... Being itself is what is.
Should we close the window?
No. Yeah, mm-hmm. Peter will get it. Well, because if a fly comes, you know, or a little bird or something. That's what they say. You have to be careful.
The cat jumps out the window?
Well, she won't, but you have to kind of be careful because, like, if a bird or something came... Then they can get focused on the bird and just fly out after the bird. She's okay now.
She's up there.
Huh?
Well,
she's
up
there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually there's not many birds over there. But sometimes.
Until there is.
Until there is.
After the owl swoops down and grabs the
kid. So, anyway. Conscious, you're the consciousness that you are, this me that you are. I like the word me because it almost, sometimes when we use the consciousness and our awareness, we always think of it in terms of aware of something, you know, aware of something. But when you think of consciousness as being, as self-evident, you know, the very personal nature of yourself and the changelessness of yourself is easier to differentiate for me. So that Satchit that is the very self of your experience becomes very clear to you once you are able to kind of break past this Dehatma Buddhi. Dehatma Buddhi means taking the Atma to be one with the body, taking the Atma to be one with the mind. If you can break past that and give the body, mind, sense organs to Ishvara, because they are as objectified as the rest of the creation, then the being that you enjoy is not contained and is not separate, can't be separate from any experience that you have. Otherwise, you have to say that the being that you are isn't, that these things don't have being, only you have being. Only you, the one who's not contained by the body, has being. None of these things have being, unless except that you give being to all of them. Just by saying it is, it is, it is, it is. The best thing to do, I think, is say it am.
Hmm.
Because there is no am is, experientially. That's another wonderful thing to see. You think that this amness is different from your experience of isness. And it isn't. There's only one experience of amness. And you can call it the whole thing isness or the whole thing amness. But once you say am is, there's a duality, and you think there's two different experiences. There isn't. Try to find it. Try to find even to locate your experience of amness, of being itself, is not something that you can objectify. But you can't objectify your experience of being. You know that you are. You know that you exist. It is experiential. Your experience of amness is experiential. But it's not something that you can objectify or look at. You can't say, look at the amness over here. And you can't say either. Like I can say, look at that painting. But I can't say, look at the isness of the painting. I can say, look at the rug. I can't say, look at the isness of the rug. Look at the being of the rug. Being is not objectifiable. Being is what is. Being is the self. Right? And so that differentiation is something to be made. Once that differentiation is made, then you are in all beings and all beings are in you. It really requires that viveka, you know, to differentiate yourself from all of the experiences that you're having. The constancy of yourself from all of the experiences that you're having. Then all of the experiences that you're having enjoy the same order of reality. You see, once you differentiate your being, which is constant, from all experience, then all experience becomes mitya. Otherwise, what happens is you maintain some sense of being satyam. You maintain some sense of being the subject, and everything else gets to be the object. But you have to give the subject over to Ishvara, really, this body-mind sense organs. The only thing that you can't give away is the Atma, because the Atma, the self, is not objectifiable. It is you. You can't give it away. You can't objectify it. You can't give it over to Ishvara. Right? You can't give it over to Maya. You can't give it into duality, because it can't be objectified. And so, but if you can't give it into duality, then it's not subject to time, it's not subject to space. It's got no size. Right? It's got to have a right side or a left side. But that's also another important meditation, is just to sit with your being and see, do you have a size? Are you big? Are you small? Do you have a color? Are you white? Are you black? Are you yellow? Is there a color? None of these words apply at all. You don't have a right side, you don't have a left side, you don't have an up, you don't have a down. And yet you are. That is the nature of being. That's the nature of non-duality. You're not big, you're not small. So you can't have, with the non-dual, you can't have a partial experience. Right? Like, if you can think, well, I'm having a partial experience of the Atma, you know? And you're having a partial experience. There is no partial. There's no partial. Because there's no duality. There's nothing to divide it. So the experience, your self-experience is Bhagavan, is Ishvara. Yourself, if we look at the self of Ishvara, Brahman, your self-experience, there's nothing objectified there. The aparoksha, satchit that you are, that is Brahman. Brahman is also not big, not small. Brahman doesn't have a color. Brahman doesn't have a size. Brahman can't be partially experienced. When you say, you are Brahman, it's not you are part of Brahman. It's you are Brahman. The self-experience has nothing to do with size. It's just me. If you get rid of the whole universe, what is left? Me. Consciousness. Not consciousness of something, just me. And that me is the self in all beings. That me is the satchit which all experience enjoys. So that now, the yoga yuktatma is the one, we say, adept at contemplation. The thing is to understand, what is this contemplation? We think of contemplation or meditation as, now I sit in a meditative posture and I withdraw my sense organs. I withdraw my sense organs, I do japa, I quieten my mind, I do all of it. This is true, that's all. That's going to be preparation for the practice of meditation. So what you're doing is preparing yourself to relax the body, for instance, so that it's not calling your attention. Quieten the, relax the sense organs, relax the mind, quieten the mind so it's not calling for your attention. Why do we even do these type of do inner child work, all of these things, in order to just relax totally the body and mind and sense organs so that the chit, the conscious being that I am, in this type of meditation that I'm talking, the conscious being that I am can become highlighted, where the being of all of these experiences is what comes to the forefront. Just my being, because everything else has, I've relaxed. So nothing else is calling my attention. So just the aparoksha me is what is in the forefront now. Mm. Now, why do I do that? Because really, the vision is this, not just the me as Brahman, just as pure Satchit. It is that I am the whole, that there is in fact nothing but that. That's Vedanta. It's not just to just go into a nirvikalpa samadhi where I'm just recognizing myself as such it without any universe. Then I have to come back and here's the universe again. That's not yoga yuktatma. For the person, for this person that we're that Krishna is talking about now, this is the person who is proficient at that. Means that's what you see. Right now, that's what you see. You see all beings in yourself and yourself in all beings. Now, that can be true even in reference to your complexes. If a complex comes, a complex is also maya. It also is mitya. It also exists within duality. It also has, you know, it also is pervaded by Satchit. It also exists in you. There's nothing about a complex that is extraordinary or outside of the creation or outside of Ishvara. There's nothing about a complex or a mood or emotion that is outside of consciousness or outside of existence. It enjoys the same Satchit as everything else. There is no level in the creation that is not Satchit, that does not have Satchit for its reality. And so you need not feel that just because a complex is there, or a mood is there, an emotion is there, that there need be self-loss. There doesn't need to be a sense of self-loss at all. But then, that complex can't have the power, you know, of dragging your buddhi off so that you rejoin samsara with that dehatma buddhi, right? That self-forgetfulness. So now, let me back up to what we were saying earlier. If you have knowledge, if you have clarity, and the mind, because of habitual thinking, you have knowledge, you have clarity, then what is truly, what might be called a meditative state is what is normal to you. That's just normal. Because we're not asking you not to experience the creation. We're not saying don't experience Ishvara. So, are you experiencing? Your eyes are open. Your sense organs are open. You're experiencing Ishvara, right? You're experiencing this duality. Do you see the Sama? Do you see the Atma everywhere? Do you see that which is the same everywhere? Do you recognize yourself as the self of all beings, in all beings? This self that I am is the self that you are. Do you know that? Do you know that the Satchit, that this experience of the world that you're having is your being? That's knowledge. If you see that, that's a meditative state. What stops you from seeing it? Are these complexes and and vaguenesses or doubts or all of these things that come in and stop you from seeing that, that Dehatma Buddhi comes in. And then you're reacting to the world in this way or that way. You're seeking Ananda out of the world and all of that. So now this is why we say meditation. Otherwise we wouldn't say meditation. Because that's just how you are. That's the reality. That's what you see. That's how you are. But the mind gets pulled into the creation and into that duality. So then what do? You bring your mind back. With what? To where? You don't bring your mind back to anywhere. You bring your knowledge in. You bring your mind, if you want to talk that way, you bring your knowledge back. You bring your mind back to yourself just simply by bringing back your knowledge. And when you bring back your knowledge, that is contemplation. That is what contemplation is. Now we differentiate it out because sometimes it's just nice, you know, you do shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So you're doing shravana, you come to class, you're doing shravana. You're studying the text, you're doing shravana. And while you're doing shravana, nididhyasana takes place every time you see. When you're doing shravana, manana takes place because that's part of the teaching methodology to do the analysis. Why can't it be this way? Why can't it be that? That's manana. Nididhyasana is as this vision, as the pramana is working, as the prakriyas are working. If the student and the teacher are together in the working of that methodology, then as the methodology unfolds, your mind is seeing that unfoldment, and that is nididhyasana. Because you're seeing it. And so sometimes we do that quietly, by ourselves, because our mind is used to getting just pulled out into the world and getting so involved, and so we sequester ourselves and just allow ourselves to see. And then sometimes, you know, as you're able to, in the world, where in the middle of everything, in the midst of it all, you see. So some people say, well, that's a walking meditation. Well, that's fine. It's an open-eye meditation. We call it things like that. But what is it, just in a simpler way? It's just seeing what I know. And my mind can take me away, and so I see what I know. Swamiji did some nice things with this on these lectures, on these tapes that we have online. So, now, he says that, let's go into the next verse. He says that the same thing in a little different way.
Yo mam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mai pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachameena pranashyati yaha mam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mayi pashyati tasya aham na pranashyami sacha me na pranashyati.
He says, yaha, he who sees me everywhere, yaha mam is me, yaha he who mam means pashyati sees sarvatra everywhere, he who sees me everywhere and sarvam cha mayi pashyati, sarvam cha, and he who sees everything in me, he who sees me everywhere, and he who sees everything in me. So now, well, tasya aham na pranashyami, for that person, I am never destroyed. I never vanish is a good way to say it. For that person, Swamiji says, I never become remote. But pranash actually means to be destroyed. So it's literally, it says, for that person, I am never destroyed, or I never disappear, I never vanish. Right? So I like vanish. Vanish is good. Or become remote has that same idea. And so he says, for him, for that person, I never disappear. And he also never disappears from me. I never disappear from him. He never disappears from me. Mm-hmm. So, here what's interesting, in verse 29, he says, that yoga yuktatma, he says, he sees the self abiding in all beings. And he sees all beings abiding in the self. Now Krishna says, he who sees me everywhere and he who sees everything in me. So now instead of the Atma, he uses me. So Krishna here is talking not as the Krishna, not as the avatar, not as the Lord in that form of Krishna. He's talking as Ishwara. And so then now here this verse really highlights the Advaita, right? Because the Lord, this Ishwara is this, right? And this has a self. So this is a conscious being, right? Which has a self. So he who sees everything in me, and he sees me in everything, is saying exactly the same thing, except using mom, right? Except using me. Because the self that I am is Ishwara. Right? This self is Ishwara. Remember, who is Ishwara when we say Ishwara? Ishwara is the one who is omniscient. The one who is omnipotent. All of these words. The one who is immanent, transcendent. We have all of these words. Sarvajnatvam means the one who knows everything. Sarvavit, the one who knows everything in detail. You know, Sarva Shaktiman, the one who has all power, all capacity. Because the one who is the Maya Vi, these are all words for Ishwara, the one who wields the Maya, the one who is the Nimitta Upadana Karanam of the creation, Nimitta Upadana Karanam. All of these, when we try to define Ishwara, these are the words that are used. Nimitta Upadana Karanam. Nimitta Karana means the efficient cause, means like if we think of the clay pot, the efficient cause would be the pot maker. The Upadana, that's the Nimitta Karana, clay pot, the Nimitta Karana is the pot maker. The Upadana Karana, the material cause, is the clay. But here Ishwara is both the Nimitta and the Upadana Karana, means that there's no separation. So this creation, so that's why sometimes the creation, in fact, is likened to a dancer, you know, in the dancing Shiva. It's likened to a dancer, because a dancer is both in the Nimitta Upadana Karanam, because the body is the dance, right? It's the instrument for the dance. And so Ishwara is viewed as a conscious being, this whole creation. Is a conscious being. It's like an infinite mind. The whole Maya, the Maya Upadi, we say Ishwara is the Maya Upadi. The Maya Upadi has this Maya Upadi, which means this infinite creation. It's like the dress, is like the body, is like the infinite mind of Ishwara. But who is Ishwara? Ishwara has this infinite body. Who is Ishwara? If I look at myself, I say, well, this is my body, mind, sense organs, but who am I? Well, I am the Atma. I am the self. I am the self, the indwelling self, the Pratyag Atma. You know, if we talk about in this, how this teaching goes, I am the Pratyag Atma. I am the conscious being that indwells this body. This body has a conscious, you know, this body enjoys a conscious being, a Dehi. The indweller of the body. That's me. I am the Atma, the one who, the conscious being, the Satchit that indwells this body. Who is Ishwara? Ishwara has this huge, infinite Maya Upadi, the whole Maya Upadi. Who is Ishwara? Ishwar is Brahman. Who is Brahman? Brahman is the conscious being that indwells the creation. The conscious being which the creation enjoys. The creation, this manifestation of this infinite manifestation, this Maya Upadhi, this creation is infinite. The one who indwells the creation must be infinite, or it only indwells part of the creation. If the conscious being indwells the creation, that conscious being must be infinite. That's why Brahman. Brahman means the conscious being which is infinite, the infinite conscious being. Brahman means that which is infinite. Okay? So the infinite self. So Ishwara's self is the infinite self because Ishwara's upadhi is infinite. This upadhi, this body, mind, sense organs, which is part of the Ishwara upadhi, is limited. Right? And so we are not going to say this limited body has a limitless self. Ishwara gets the limitless self because Ishwara's body is limitless, so he gets to have a limitless self. Huh. My body is limited, so I get to have a limited self. Right? So that's samsara. That's the ajnanam. And it makes sense, you know, that a limited self, you know, indwells a limited body, and a limitless self indwells a limitless body. So that's what we think. Ishwara is limitless, limitless being. And I am limited being. But the Mahavakya is that you are Brahman. Is that you, the Atma, this that you take to be this limitless being because it indwells, this limited being because it indwells a limited body, you take that limited being to be that, limited, subject to this physical body. And that's why this differentiation between the conscious being that you are from the limited upadhi that you've superimposed yourself upon, that's why it's so important, because how can you be Ishwara? How can the self that you are be Ishwara? You're limited. Right? And so this body, mind, sense organs has to be given back to the Maya Upadhi that it belongs in. This body, mind, sense organs is part of the Ishwara Upadhi. It is part of Ishwara. It belongs to Ishwara. It is taken care of by Ishwara. It is part of Ishwara's story. And the Jivan Mukta lets it be part of Ishwara's story. The life, it's very the life that it has, the karma that caused it to take this birth and live out this life, all of the relationships, all of the interrelatedness, it's all Ishwara. The mind, all of the capacities of the mind, including all of the defense systems we have and all of the complexes we have and all of the ways of storing those complexes and all of the ways of projecting the complexes, all of it is all part of duality. Duality is the Maya Upadhi, is Ishwara. And that Ishwara has a limitless self, which is me, right? Unless the self that I am is actually belongs to this physical body. If the self that I am isn't contained in this physical body, is not objectifiable, is not something that takes on the qualities of the body, the mind, the sense organs, then if it's not, if it can't be objectified and exist as an entity in duality, how can you separate it from, make it not limitless? How can you make the self that you are not limitless? To make the self that you are limited, you have to go into Maya and grab something. You have to stick that self into duality. And the only things that exist in duality are your body, your mind, your sense organs. All of these are objectifiable. All of these have parts. All of these exist within duality. You can't stick consciousness in there. Consciousness isn't something that you can objectify and stick in there. And so the self that you are is limitless, and that limitless has nothing to do with space. We think of the Maya Upadhi as limitless spatially, time-wise, qualitatively. It is. Whole universe. And so then we think, when we think of Brahman, right, the limitless Maya Upadhi, Brahman has to be limitless. If the limitless Maya Upapati, then Brahman has to be limitless. Then we think limitless in terms of space. But if you get rid of the Maya Upadi, there is no space, there is no time, there is no duality. And so by limitless, we don't mean limitless in terms of space or time. We mean limitless in terms of it is the only being that is there. It is the only Sat-Chit that is there. There isn't a second Sat-Chit. And so there's no other thing. That has nothing to do with size. It means this me, the conscious being that I am, is what is. And there is nothing that doesn't enjoy that. Size, space, dimension, duality, extension, all belongs to the Maya. None of it belongs to me. That's why if you use your imagination, you can really appreciate this. I can ask you to imagine a meadow with a sky and clouds and the sun and trees and mountains and animals and people enjoying the meadow. And then you can enjoy it, you can walk in the meadow. That huge imagination is taking place in you, who haven't become small or huge. Right? You haven't become huge, you haven't stayed small, nothing. Imagination can be of any size. You can imagine a universe. And your being pervades that imagination without changing in size. Right? Your being is the being of the imagination. Your being doesn't change in size. And so that's that freedom. The limitlessness is not limitlessness in terms of size. It's in terms of all that is. It's all that is. And so the limitless Brahmanness of Brahman, the Brahmanness of Brahman, is not in terms of size. It's in terms of what is. And so when we say you are Brahman, you also are not in terms of size. You are what is. See what I mean? That's what makes you infinite. That's why you can be Brahman. It has nothing to do with size. It has to do simply with what is. Now, if you think about that, if your mind's not zeroing in on the moment, when you're doing a meditation, you should just notice yourself, the conscious being that you are. It has nothing to do with size, but it has no edges. It's not about size, but it has no edges. Except there is nothing else. And so here, for the person who recognizes that, there is no escape. There is no escape. Ishvara can't get away from you, and you can't get away from Ishvara. There's no place to go where one can be away from the other. The Atma can't separate from Brahman because the Atma is Brahman. And the creation has no being apart from Brahman. So there's nowhere, the creation has no being apart from Sat-Chit. So there's nowhere that you can go to get away from Ishvara, or Ishvara can go to get away from you, because there is nothing else. And so when that's clear, like in I think Katha Upanishad, they say, you know, if you send your mind to the moon, you know, send your mind to the moon, yourself is already there. Right? So where can you send your mind, you know, where the self is not? So another way you can say it, where could you send, you know, just accepting this whole Maya Upadi, where can you go in this Maya Upadi, even talking about going into subtle levels or complexes or all of these kind of things, or in terms of spatially, where can I go where Ishvara is not? I mean, obviously, where can I go where the self is not? Nowhere. Where can I go where Brahman is not? Nowhere, because I am that, and there is no place that is not. But then in terms of this Maya Upadi, where can I go where Ishwara is not? Where can I go where the self is not? There's no exception. There's no place that you can go. And so how can one leave the other? On any level at all, how can one leave the other? Even on the level of the Upadis, where can this Upadi go that is not Ishwara? Where can this physical Upadi go in the entire creation on every dimension that is not Ishwara? Or that is away from the self? And even in terms of my moods and my emotions and my complexes and all of the laws of the creation, where can I go that is separate, you know, where the self is not? You can't. And so as the mind realizes the reality of this, no matter where your mind is in terms of your emotions or the things that you're working on or you're trying to improve about yourself, and all of these things that we do as human beings, you know. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever you're working on, you are there. May sound silly, but you are Ananda. Wholeness is there. The person who is full, the person who is complete, the Atma, is there. There's no distance. So if the mind is in pain, it just takes the slightest recognition, you know, just to turn, to recognize, you know, the clay of the pot, to recognize your own presence. That's meditation. That moment is meditation. Just that moment. And this is not, there's no distance. There's no distance, there's no time. So it's just that moment. That moment is meditation. That moment is recognition. That moment is knowledge. See what I mean? Because there's no distance to go. So the problem is having the wherewithal to bring in that knowledge when the mind's having a problem. That's why we practice meditation, to build up that strength, you know. Also, you know, all of these things that we learn, like how to be with the mind, inner child work, how to be an inner friend, all of these things are they're tools that everybody should know. You should all know this. It's education. It's like once somebody said, it's a little tangential, but not really. The most important thing we do in our life, perhaps, is to raise our children. You know, to raise your child. And there aren't any courses or anything. From the person who said, there's no teaching. You know, you teach all these other things, but there's no teaching, you know, how to raise your child, what the child really, really needs, just to have some understanding, you know, about the different developmental stages and what a child needs. It's not mandatory. It's not included in the educational system. Now, but another thing that is not really included is how to be with your mind, you know? How to handle it in a way that can allow it to grow and to mature and to not be hurt. You know, how to be with the mind in a way that will allow it to survive traumas and hurt feelings and all of the different things that happen in life. Mm. Things that once they're taught, you know, we learn them now, and once they're taught, that makes all the difference in the world, like just the inner friend. To have an inner friend inside who's not a critic, but somebody who's that part of it that's supportive, it makes all of the difference. You know? So all of these things, even and now what we're talking about now, just in a really an understanding of meditation. Meditation to me is also it's a word that has been taken away from us, made into something that's removed, like, can I meditate? You know, can I have a deep meditation? Can I go into nirvikalpa samadhi? Have you gone into nirvikalpa? You know, it's taken away from us. Instead of just the very simple thing that it is. It's knowledge. And that's why in Vedanta, in the whole teaching methodology, you can't meditate without knowledge. Meditation is knowledge. It's bringing your knowledge in. And that knowledge that you're bringing in is aparoksha. It's not book learning. That's what makes it meditation. Meditation means seeing. It's the actual seeing of what you know. That's, we talk about it like that. It's the seeing of what you know. The seeing of what you know. What you know is what? It's your knowledge. And that knowledge is something that's aparoksha because that knowledge is not away from you. And so knowledge is alive. It's seen. It has to do with seeing. It doesn't have to do with, you know, with pages on a book. You know, you can read pages on a book, but for in terms of Vedanta, what those pages on the book say, you have to see it in order for it to be doing its job. Okay, stop there.
Oh, marvelous.
Yeah, this is a beautiful section.
Yeah.
Very famous. Yeah. Yeah, they are famous verses. Purnamidah, Purnamidah, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
So the reason that this particular verse occurs in the chapter on Dhyan is because yoga, which means
this is the vision.
This is the vision where Ishvara,
that is the knowledge. And that's the vision in meditation also, that's what you see. But you see it here too. That's why sometimes when you understand the oneness between meditation and knowledge, I think is helpful. Because it's seen. Knowledge also is seen. You know, that's why they use that verb ikshate, means to see.
I don't know why I still have trouble seeing the meaning outside. Outside. Whatever that means. But it still seems like I just can recognize myself, but the self that I am. But it doesn't seem like that self is the self of everything.
Well, when you see the the self that you are, can you see it's kind of a sangha, you know, in reference to the thought? I've asked you this before.
Which thought?
Any thought.
Oh.
Like any thought that you have,
mm-hmm.
That thought is pervaded by consciousness, by sat chit.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see that the sat chit is free of the thought?
Mm-hmm.
Experientially, you recognize it?
Yeah.
What's the difference then? See, this is a thought, this room.
Yeah. I think that's a problem. It's understanding that that everything comes to as a thought.
Well, you're seeing, like, say this room. We get rid of the, we make this room into mitya by analyzing name and form. But experientially, you are perceiving this room because you have eyes. Without your eyes, you couldn't perceive the room, right? So, I mean, at least the color, the name and form. So what that means is that your eyes are used as a tool, as an instrument of knowledge, sense organ, to form a thought modification in your mind, which you illumine.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So now if I ask you to have an imagination of a meadow, now you've imagined that, and you are illumining it. And you can tell there that, oh, the awareness is free and pervades it.
Yeah.
But if you have a thought modification of this room that is generated by sense perception, still a thought modification, it's just the same. It's the same being that pervades it. So what you should do then, so an exercise you can do, is when in contemplation, one of the reasons like we sit for contemplation is just to be able to recognize the satchit that I am, so that I know that. And then I notice in every vritti, that satchit is changeless. Vritti after vritti after vritti, the names and forms change, the satchit doesn't. Just like if you were to have an imagination and get rid of the imagination, satchit is the same. So then you start recognizing that satchit is never, ever not here. It never changes. It's never not here. You can't have any type of experience that isn't full of only of that. That's the sum, what they mean by sama. It is always the same. There's no place where it is not. Now you've differentiated it. Right? That's the satyamitya. Satyamitya, satchit, namarupa. Right? That's satyamitya. The satchit, the existence, consciousness, is the sama, is always the same. Everywhere. That's satyam. Mitya are the names and forms that enjoy the satchit when they're there. But they are coming and going. Always changing. Coming into being, going out of being. So they don't have any being of their own. The satchit being stays constant.
And so while they're there, as a vritti, while they're perceived, then they're pervaded by awareness. And that's the way the satchit pervades. Is that it?
We say that wherever the vritti, because there is really nothing but satchit.
Yeah.
Right? So any vritti that is there is going to be pervaded by it, because there is nothing but that.
Right.
Right? So now, what you have to do is differentiate that which is there always.
Well, how do you do that when everything's changing? How do you spot the changeless?
Well, because you're not changing. Consciousness is not changing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of looking at it, because consciousness is self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the one that's not changing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you spot it. You recognize that the consciousness and being is not changing, and everything else is.
Hmm.
Everything comes and goes in that. That's the stable.
And it's not any more complex than what you just said now?
It isn't, but you have to recognize it.
Hmm.
So you could basically say the screen in the movie theater.
Uh-huh.
So this screen is satchit, and then the movie that gets projected on that screen, whether the movie is on or not, the screen is there, right? The senses are what projects the duality phenomena on the screen. So it looks like there's this movie running on the screen, and the movie looks really real, but it's actually the screen that somehow...
Sometimes they say it that way as an example. Of course, all examples have their limitations, but that's one. Another is to say, you know, in the movie there's the light that is going through the film strip,
uh-huh.
And the light...
Right.
Never modifies or changes, and without the light, nothing could be seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the constant. But here, with those examples, there's still some duality, but they make a point.
But you know, complexes seem more changeless.
They're real. They seem more real because there's pain involved with a complex. You know, isolation and pain and all of these hard experiences. That's why even in psychology, sometimes there's certain experiences that guilt, shame, fear, these kind of experiences are hard. The person just wants to run away from any experience like that, shame and guilt especially, you know, and fear. Really shame and fear, the worst. So when those kind of complexes, these kind of experiences are there, the mind doesn't just want to say, oh, let me experience that. But in fact, that's what is very helpful to say. Like if you feel shame, okay, let me see what shame is. Shame is part of Ishwara also. These are experiences, you know.
But some of those things seem like lifetime. I mean, you can get into some kind of psychological way, and it just permanent.
Doesn't have to be.
But it seems that way.
Well, you know, one example, I forget his name, famous, not that well-known, but within the field, a well-known psychologist, used this example. About somebody who was a wounded person, psychologically wounded, who's, you know, he likened it like this. Say you have two beautiful Chinese vases. Beautiful. They're identical. But one had been dropped and had crashed to the ground into many pieces, and a master craftsman had come and put that vase back together. They're both so that from the naked eye you could really be very hard to see. You know? But nevertheless, that vase that had been healed still was different than the one that hadn't broken. It still had those cracks. But the thing is, the cracks were all repaired. And so what they say is like that for our complexes, like we are all wounded in one way or another when we're growing up. Some people worse than others. You have had harder time than others, but everyone has their complexes, and you can work through those, you know, but that little line is still there. It's like you don't forget, you know. It's not that situation went into making you who you are now. All of those complexes, they went into creating you, the personality and all that. So all of that is there. It's just that when you heal them, they don't have the capacity to really hurt you like they did before. But they have gone into forming your personality, so that your character and all of that. So, and that you don't have to look at that as a positive or negative. It's not positive or negative. It's just, you know, this is your mind and how you have to be with your mind.
So say maybe there's a tiny bit of hurt there, then this Satyam Mitya comes into play. And
well, that's why we do all this inner child or good inner friend. Like say there's the mind is hurt. What attitude you're feeling? Say like your feelings are hurt. Somebody hurt your feelings. Mm-hmm. I say inner friend, but now another way is what we're really saying is how do you hold that hurt? With what voice, with what attitude do you hold that hurt? Now, say if that person that was hurt was a friend or was your child, you know, then how would you hold your friend? How would you be with your friend? How would you be with your child if that had happened? It should be comparable, you know. If you can be loving toward your friend, or sympathetic, or wanting to help, but you can't be toward yourself. then yourself becomes, you have an inner environment toward yourself that's very punishing.
Mm-hmm.
But not an inner an environment toward your friend. Toward your friend you can be kind and loving and caring.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're hurt or when something has happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, or even when you're failing at something or even unable to live up to your own standards of how you want to be, how are you toward that?
Mm-hmm.
How would you be toward a friend or toward your child? You know, you just don't worry, you have to, you just keep trying, you're doing your best, that's all. That's all that you're doing your best. So there's a kindness there, there's an kind of a wisdom or an understanding.
So your Vedanta can still be good, even if, say your samsara, the world of those pains and the world of samsara is kind of messy or sloppy or not.
Well, I mean, that's what we want,
yeah.
Is that, because there's an emotional lifetime, but the buddhi, you know, has knowledge and nishta way before the manas.
Mm.
It does. It's just how it is. Your nishta, the nishta of the buddhi comes way before the maturity of the mind. The maturity of the mind catches up in time. But if the buddhi has that nishta, then the part of that nishta has to do with how to be with. What gives you the nishta means that you can be with those complexes in a way that can, that is healing, like you can be with others in a way that's helpful and healing.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that. It seems like some people are exactly like you say, especially in this tradition. Buddha understands first and the manas takes a long time before. But then other people have more of this manas thing down, and they have the compassion down towards other people and towards oneself, and have the whole sense of, yes, the self is really in everything, this is all Ishvara, but they totally lack the logical structure.
Well, then we would say, that's true. That means that antakarana shuddhi is there.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. But say it isn't. We're talking about people who have their complexes and hurts, mm-hmm. and how to be with that. But the antakarana shuddhi can be there, like for Ramana, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Or even Shvetaketu in the Chandogya Upanishad, he asked his dad, you know, 12 times, and then he went off and all was fine. But in this, for most of us, you know, there's things
mm-hmm.
in the psyche, hurts and pains, whatnot, that need to be handled. And then if there's no understanding about how to be with that, then
you're stuck.
Then it's
very difficult.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
But if you know how to be with it, then that part of you is being cared for, just like, you know, hurt parts in the world. You know, can get the same attention, should get the same attention.
Mm.
Should get the same.
Because, you know, it can be more than just your own problems. This world has a pile of problems, too. I mean, you know, it comes from all directions.
That's right.
You know, to be an inner a friend to the world also. I mean, to your own psyche. And then to these crazy people out there. You know?
It's challenging.
Huh?
Challenging.
Yeah.
So is the understanding of the Satchit that also happens through the vritti, right? I mean, isn't the vritti also involved in that recognition?
It's involved in the recognition, but the Satchit is actually aparoksha. It's self-evident. But the problem is that the vritti, the mind, because of ignorance, has always, you know, superimpose the two together, that anyonya adhyasa, that mutual superimposition.
Uh-huh.
That's always been there, right? And so it's the mind that has to gain the knowledge to have that ignorance removed. But the mind isn't illumining the satchit. The satchit is the luminary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the mind recognizes that this luminary, me, the self, is free of the vritti.
Mm.
Is the self of the vritti, but free of the vritti.
The mind recognizes that it's free of the vritti?
the mind recognizes that the self itself, the Atma,
right,
is changeless.
Right, but the vritti and the mind always, the vritti doesn't exist separate from the mind.
No, I just use mind and vritti.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
You know, Carol, I think I understand. I think I understand what my problem is. It's like I see that the satchit illumines the vritti, pervades the vritti, pervades whatever nitya thing is going on in the vritti. But so, like, I always think, well, like, that's my mind, you know, that's my mind, and it belongs to this body or somehow this upadhi, right? So I guess I have a sneaky suspicion, like, that book is not part of this upadhi. It can be part of Ishwara's upadhi, but it's not part of this particular upadhi, and it's known to me through the mind. So how do I really know that the Atma pervades that book when I'm not looking at, or, you know, no, I don't
well,
mean it,
yeah,
right?
But,
it's silly as that, but, you know, how do I know that the Atma pervades everything? I can see it pervades the cognition.
Well, first of all, you have to see that the Atma, in fact, is not pervading anything. It's not the Atma's going out and pervading things. The Atma is non-objectifiable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it is not an object within creation, subject to change or anything like this.
Yeah.
So that the Atma that you are is, it's not that it's pervading, it's that there is nothing outside of it. There can't be, there's no space, there's no time for consciousness, right? Time and space all belong within duality. So consciousness doesn't have time or space, right? It's just the bottom line. It just is what is. Okay, so now, and that consciousness isn't illumining your mind in the sense of not illumining all. It's not doing an act of just illumining your mind, right? It's let me illumine Dunya's mind.
No.
It's not doing that.
No.
It just is consciousness. Right?
Okay.
So now you from the standpoint of the creation, here's this body, mind, sense organs in the creation. Okay? So this is only one mind in this creation, right? But all minds in the creation equally enjoy that one non-dual being that is not about time or space. Okay? Okay, so now you see that.
Yeah.
This mind now is a vritti, thought modification, that has the contents, whatever contents are there, said they're born through sense perception. Right? So now you've got a vritti of something, a vritti of this room, a vritti of the painting. Now, that little vritti of yours is illumined. The whole vritti, everything in it, equally enjoys consciousness. Right? That's just a fact. So you can use that to say, okay, in my experience as a jiva, everything that I experience equally enjoys consciousness. So now, in my experience here, now I'm looking at this room. So I'm seeing with my peripheral vision, I'm seeing the whole room, some of the ceiling, some of the floor. I'm seeing my body. Right? That's included in this vision. Now, in terms of the reality of the experience of this vritti plus consciousness, this entire vision equally enjoys consciousness, not one part more or less. Right?
What do you mean? What?
Yeah.
Well, I have this vritti of the room.
Yeah.
The whole vritti enjoys satchit, consciousness. Because the whole vritti is in consciousness. The whole thing is known to me equally. Not one part more or less than another. It's whatever is in the vritti enjoys equally satchit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that, I have no other experience than that. So now the question is, does the reality of what I'm perceiving through my sense organs, does that have a reality which is different? Is not mithya? does this reality that I experience, because I can say my vritti, you know, enjoys satchit, the satchit is changeless, the vritti, you know, I can see how it is mitya, I can see the satyam mitya in reference to the vritti, right? But can the objects that are, the sense organs are the objects out there, which I'm experiencing in the vritti, do those objects, are those objects mitya? Or do they have some reality apart from, away from consciousness? Do they have any independent reality? No? Then there's no problem.
So is it that you, that what is that that you say? There's a phrase for it, like it's kind of like you make a, you, without reminding me, have this limited vritti. And so then you extrapolate, that's not quite the right word, but then you just know that that's the same everywhere.
That's right.
Yeah.
Logical extension. Yeah.
So if we're all sitting here now and we're listening to this, what you just said, that we are satchit, would somehow all most likely agreeing to about that, you know, because that's kind of self-evident in a certain way, mm-hmm. the way of especially how you're unfolding it. Now to really... Now, to actually not only experience that anymore, because there's a certain kind of my personal experience, it's not so much about my personal experience, even though it is, but what I'm saying is there's a difference between, there's a certain kind of time factor that comes in, because, you know, a long time ago I asked you once, I said, you know, do you think that has anything to do with self-remembrance? And you said no. You know, because it actually has to do with understanding. So I'm just saying, so there's a certain understanding we all have to a certain degree of what you just said. But now, there's a time factor so that allows that to really come through. It's not like, you know, whether there's a forgetfulness, that we get stuck back in the vritti, you know, that something in us chooses vritti over satchit or something, and that's deconditioning seems to be have a deep relationship to time, right?
If the deconditioning, or if that's a word you want to use, it takes place in time.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. That's basically what it is, because yeah. See, in this moment I can see this, but then I walk out the door and it's this massive conditioning from what
exactly. And the, yeah, that
catches up with me, you know,
yeah.
Very quick. And
the massive conditioning has to, it keeps presenting itself to knowledge. It needs to present itself to knowledge and slowly be assimilated.
Well, that's what you said earlier, that contemplation was the same as knowledge.
What?
You said that...
Yeah, because when you bring your knowledge to it,
yeah.
Then that transforms the conditioning.
So that's a process that you have to make strong for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happens naturally, too. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anton?
I was just saying, it keeps eclipsing knowledge.
Yeah, like.
As if the experience of satchit being Purnam is not strong enough or almost complete enough to eradicate it there and then. And if I put my hand in fire and it burns, that's enough. Once is enough to know that it's not worth going back and putting my hand in fire. But yet it doesn't seem to happen in this meditation. When I analyze this situation, back to satchit.
You know what? That's good. The reason for that is that the what we call the adhikarityam, the qualified student condition, is not enough. Because you can get to a point before coming to knowledge that your assimilation of experience is such that you recognize that there's no real ananda to be gained from the creation, that everything is finite and temporary, I can't fulfill myself. And your mind has had the chance to assimilate that before coming to knowledge. But usually we come to knowledge with only enough assimilation of that fact to make us into a mumukshu, one who desires liberation.
Mm-hmm.
But there's what they call the uttama adhikari, that just has to see it here at once. You know, like Shweta Ketu, he heard his father told him 12 times. He'd tell him once, and then he said to his father, Could you tell me that one more time, Father? And so his father told a little different version. 12 times, and then, oh, I see. And he went. He was fine, no problem. Because his mind had already done all of that. He had the vairagya. Vairagya means he had that dispassion, thinking that, oh, this universe can really provide me with the happiness I seek. So because we come with baggage, it takes time. Because that baggage has to be assimilated in time. I still have in so many ways. Well, I know this doesn't really make me happy, but I do need this to become happy. And, you know, I know this, but still, I want things to be in this way. There's all kinds of levels of that, a lot of which can be taken care of before you come to knowledge. But does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there anything that dissembles Vairagya?
I knew somebody was going to do that.
Is there anything that would do it? Is there anything beside knowledge that does that?
That does what?
That dissembles the...
disempowers? I mean...
Yeah, our life experience.
Because of dispassion, I'm just saying, the dispassion, does it only come from...
It comes from life experience.
Mm-hmm.
You can have just such a high degree of dispassion because life tells you that over and over, and finally you get it over and over and over again. You know that life gives you moments of happiness. You know, you work and work and work to do something, you think, oh, this is it. And you finally fulfill that desire, and you have a great moment of happiness, but that's where the moment of happiness. And then within how many seconds does the next thought come, well, now, but this could happen and that could happen, or now I need this also.
I want more.
And so at some point, you really understand
mm-hmm.
that there might be joys and whatnot that happen that you can get from life, but you can't get a situation where now you can say, okay, now all is well with me.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't find yourself in the creation. You can't find that stable, whole person in the creation, because mm-hmm. everything that you've identified with as being yourself is subject to change. So there is no, you're not identified with any type of a constant. So you can't make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And you go on and on experiencing that and kind of understanding the nature of the creation. And also, your mind, to really abide in this knowledge, has to have dharma. And dharma is something also we can and do learn through experience. You know, because dharma, putting your hand in fire is the example we use for dharma. You know, if you put your hand in fire, it creates pain. Adharma creates pain. And you learn that. You learn that dharma gives shanti and adharma creates pain. And you slowly, you know, we assimilate. And so once the mind has vairagya and dharma, it has maturity in those two, then that is an uttama adhikari. That mind has shanti. It's got shanti, peace. It's not asking the world to solve the problem. It's just burning for knowledge. It's just ripe and ready for knowledge. And then when it's like the example they use is like a, you know, just a flamed paper. Just. Phew.
Did you say uttama?
Uttama. Uttama means the highest level of qualified student.
Oh, okay.
And then there's madhyama. Is the middling, and then mandana is a dull.
Mm-hmm.
A dull?
Dull.
Dull.
Yeah, dull. Yeah.
It seems like dukkham, a certain input of dukkham in one's life.
It's a teacher.
It actually
shani.
Helps to bring, yeah, it helps actually to bring in the dispassion component, right? Because the more sukham you have, the more you get kind of illusioned by the whole thing. Kind of seems that way.
Yeah, Dukkha is the great teacher.
Yeah.
They say that. It's mm-hmm. Saturn, you know.
For one who has maturity, if not, it can just make you more of a deranged person.
Yeah, hopefully. They said that hopefully it takes you in the right direction. You know, it's like a fire, they say. You know, you can, fire can purify or it can destroy into ashes.
So the dukkham can also involve even a deeper longing for the sukham, right? And a certain kind of psychological, emotional dependency of that.
Or,
mm-hmm.
or it's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, that's right.
Interesting. Yeah.
You done? Hi, Jeff.